in your text to Galatians, the second chapter, in verse 9. That section begins at the first of the chapter, dealing with the subject of Paul's run-in with Peter as a result of Peter's hypocrisy. You may remember that on that occasion, Peter had accepted the fellowship of Gentiles and was eating with them until the time that the Jews with James came into the group. And as a result of that, he withdrew himself in a hypocritical way. And as a result of that, Paul had withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. There is that reference that we were talking about. That begins in verse 11 and going down through. One of the reasons why the Apostle Paul deals with this particular issue is to emphasize his authority as an apostle. He, as we've talked about, did that on many occasions. But in the ninth verse, there's a phrase that is used that he emphasizes for the purpose of establishing the legitimacy of his apostleship that we wanted to address. In verse 9, it says that James, Cephas, and John, who seem to be pillars there in Jerusalem, received the grace that had been given to me. And so they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship. Now that's a phrase that we have used on a number of occasions. The right hand of fellowship, we should go to the Gentiles and they should be circumcised. I wanted just to examine that phrase for just a moment. It won't take long to do that. The right hand of fellowship. I'm personally left-handed. When I read that, it's always a little bit of irony that there's some distinction made and some preference given right hand or left. But I understand certainly what is meant by that. And when you use that, we commonly, for example, will think in our minds a handshake. And I think that there's a similar picture, at least, that is given in this particular case. Not necessarily a handshake in the traditional way that we do it. I don't know exactly when that practice became prominent and whether it's prevalent in other cultures or not. But the right hand of fellowship is an extension of the hand for the purpose of showing approval. And that's certainly what was done on this particular occasion. The concept of fellowship is an important one. We have talked about this quite extensively, about those to whom we can and should extend fellowship, and those that we cannot or should not extend fellowship to. And so this particular occasion, this particular phrase indicates the approval that was shown to the Apostle Paul on the part of these three individuals specifically, but the brethren there in Jerusalem, James, Cephas, and John. The fact that they understood and recognized, this is where the concept of fellowship comes in that I think is important for us to emphasize. They understood that what the Apostle Paul was doing was something that was acceptable to God. It was something that was what was derived from that was God's favor. God appreciated and approved of what the Apostle Paul was doing. And as a result of that, they appreciated and approved of it as well. And they extended that hand of fellowship. But he's using that as evidence that Peter and John, when he made the claim, I'm an apostle too, that they were in agreement with him, or else they would not have extended that right hand of fellowship. So that's the purpose of it. Now, just to make note, so that there's some independent verification of the claim that he makes there, I'd like you to turn very quickly over to 2 Peter, the third chapter. 2 Peter chapter 3. It's another passage that we have looked at on a number of occasions for other reasons. But I want you to know in verse 15, this is the writing of Peter. Peter says in verse 15, "Consider the long-suffering of our Lord as salvation, as also our beloved brother Paul, according to the wisdom given to him, has written to you." So two things that are noted in this verse. Number one, he calls him a beloved brother, which again is an indication of his approval of Paul as an an apostle. Secondly, he indicates that what Paul was delivering to them was something that was delivered to him. That is, it was not of his own authority or derived from himself, but rather it came from God. Now, of course, that is exactly what the Apostle Paul was claiming in his epistles. What I say, I'm not saying as a usurper. I'm not saying it on my own authority. I am speaking what I have been given, what I have been told to speak. My apostleship is not from men, but it is from God. And you see that corroborated very, very clearly in just that one single verse about those two points. He calls him a beloved brother and indicates that his wisdom had been given to him. That confirms basically what the Apostle Paul claims. And that, of course, despite the fact that there was that conflict that existed between them, as indicated there in Galatians chapter 2. So I wanted to make note of that phrase, right hand fellowship. We use it, and again, we may even say it in a somewhat facetious way when we shake someone's hand that we're extending the right hand of fellowship. A couple of times I've done that. If it's got something in my right hand, I'll extend my left hand of fellowship for that same purpose. But it's an indication of approval. It's an indication that we recognize the legitimacy of an individual's claim that they are accepted of God. And so we bring them into our fellowship. We are in concord with them as a result of their standing with God. Fellowship is based first upon the relationship we sustain with God. We have no right to extend that fellowship to individuals who are not accepted of God. It doesn't mean we don't have anything to do with them if they're in the world, or that we do not try to admonish those who may be in the church who have fallen away. But it is an indication, again, of the concept of acceptance and approval in that term fellowship that's used there in that text. All right, questions, comments about that particular passage? Yes?
Well, this is just totally peripheral here, but in verse 9, or verse 8, he mentions his name as Peter, and then in verse 9, it says Cephas, and I just wonder if there's anything to that, why it would switch back and forth between the two names. I know that they're both the same, but is one more formal than the other, or
I don't know.
Just curiosity.
I'm not exactly sure. Just that it's talking about the same guy. That's all I can tell you. I don't know if there's anybody have any ideas or
what was it?
He was asking the question, why is he called Peter, referred to him as Peter in verses 7 and 8, and then Cephas in verse 9.
Oh, yeah, it was different language than Peter's name. My name is Benjamin Mark. Name is John. Maybe an Aramaic and Greek.
Okay, it may be that there is an Aramaic term that he uses, because the majority of the New Testament is written in Greek, but there are some Aramaic.
Yeah, terms. Well, I think that's it. But I just wondered why he would go back and forth. It's kind of more subtle than I can imagine.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I can look and see if anybody has any ideas, but I'm not even talking about it. Okay, let us go down into the next question. Actually, it's the next question on the list, though we're going to skip a lot of them. We've discussed many of these questions as a part of our discussions and studies previously, and I don't want to be too repetitive. But I do want to make note of Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, another phrase that is used there. I love this passage. I quote it quite often because I think it has a very beneficial application to us in our lives as Christians. The Apostle Paul made the statement, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. The life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. The question is, what does it mean that Christ lives in me? What does that phrase mean? And, I have a tendency to just answer the questions as I ask them, but I'll ask that and see if anyone wants to pontificate upon
the moment of teaching Christ.
Following his teachings, okay?
Being obedient.
All right.
He's doing what Christ says, do not what? Flesh.
Okay, so it's a concept of authority there. And I think that's what I get out of it. Basically, there are two things that I get out of it. Number one, when he says, I'm not living, it's Christ living in me. It's an indication that the decisions that I make as a person now, the will that I follow is not my own, but rather whether it is the will of another. There are other ways of illustrating it other than what the Apostle Paul does here by indicating that it is Christ in me. He calls himself a bondservant of Jesus Christ, for example. And that term, doulos, bondservant, or slave, indicates that another is his master. When I become a child of God, the concept of being self-willed is something that should go out the window. Now, again, this is a matter of intent. It's not a matter of reality in the sense that I have no more free will. The free will continues, but I have made the determination to subjugate my will to that of another. I'm determined by Christ's will rather than mine. So, as I live my life, it's not me doing what I want to do. My life is governed by Christ. And in that way, can be said that Christ lives in me. The second thing to make note of in that particular passage is as a Christian, when people identify themselves, you ask the question, how do you self-identify? That's a phrase that you hear these days. It's something to do with psychology, I suppose. But how do you self-identify? And we hear people that will make reference to their sexual identities. They'll make reference to their cultural identities. There's a really big thing out there these days about making a distinction between an individual's physical sex and their gender identity. In other words, biologically, are you male or female? Okay, you're a male. But how do you identify in gender? And there are individuals now. Those of us who are normal are now no longer normal. We are cisgender. Whereas those, that means that our... I say I use these phrases because I've been reading and looking at my wife. Because it is, it's rather peculiar. It's made up words based on what it is. They've coined terms. But it is basically that your biological sex is the same as how you identify or self-identify with regard to your gender. Where others are transgenders. You've heard that term more commonly. Some of you may be familiar with, I think it's in the state of Washington, to where there was a woman who was the president of a local chapter of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, who actually was white, but she identified as a black person. And that was the claim that was made. And so those kinds of things are out there these days. And it's kind of interesting, and it is indicative of how people, what importance they place upon certain aspects of their life. That when you ask them, how do you identify yourself? Not specifying gender or specifying race or anything like that, but just the general question. If I were to ask you to describe yourself, to explain who it is you are, then most people don't even consider spirituality at all. They'll identify themselves. Some of them politically, some of them will identify themselves with regard to their gender or sexual preference. That's very common today. Some will identify themselves as race, those kinds of things. But you don't hear too many people basically saying, I identify myself as a follower of Christ. And I want you to understand that in this phrase, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And it's indicative of the fact that if I become a child of God, being a Christian is not part of who I am. It is who I am. And I think that's really, to a certain extent, where our society is got it wrong. Because you have an awful lot of people who self-identify as Christians in a sense, but Christianity is a part of them, not who they are. And so it's not a matter of how they fully identify themselves, it's just one aspect of their being. And what the Apostle Paul is here saying is this is what I am. I am a Christian. This is what it's all about. This is the essence of me is I no longer live, but now Christ is living in me. And so I think it's a very strong statement that I love to look at, because when you have individuals today that they claim to be Christians and yet their Christian walk is less than fully committed. They are maintaining friendship with the world, they are grudging with regard to their fulfillment of their responsibilities, whether it be with regard to attendance, study, evangelism, giving, those kinds of things. They are not identifying themselves as individuals, their existence, as the Apostle Paul is in this particular place. And this is what God requires of us. And so from this point on, I've become a child of God. From now on, it's no longer I who live. From now on, my life is not something that is impelled by what I desire and what I want, but what Christ desires and what Christ wants for me. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. So I think there is that recognition of authority, but also there is something there concerning the extent to which he identifies himself as a bondservant of Jesus Christ. And it's one that we would do well to emulate, and I wanted to bring that up as well. Questions, comments? All right, and the third of the four that we want to make note of is found in chapter 6 and verses 7 and 8. And this is one that's a bit more practical. Chapter 6, verses 7 through 8. And it's used in a number of different ways in Scripture. But it is what we'll refer to as the concept or the law of sowing and reaping. Now notice in verse 7. In verse 7 and 8 is what we're going to read. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. It's a principle that we understand biologically. We recognize that when you put kernel of corn in the ground, that an ear of corn is what's going to come up as a result of that. An acorn in the ground, you're going to get another tree. That's sowing and reaping. If you sow one thing, you do not get another. You get the same kind. And individuals today, again, have this idea or concept that I'm going to be sowing a life that is less than stellar with regard to my demeanor toward God and my righteousness before Him, and yet despite that, God is going to have mercy on me, and I'm going to be able to reap everlasting life, even though I've not sown in my life that which would be worthy of that reward. And of course, that's a concept that I think is very prevalent religiously today because of Calvinism. And what the Apostle Paul indicates very clearly here is that's not the case. If you're going to go to heaven, it is necessary that you live a righteous life, because individuals who with the flesh sow to the flesh, that is, his demeanor, manner of life is that of worldliness, well, then he will reap as a result of that corruption. And we recognize the corruption there in verse 8 has reference to physical or spiritual death, because the contrast to that is sowing in the Spirit, will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. So the corruption there has reference to spiritual death, whereas everlasting life is spiritual life. That's what's under consideration. We're talking about eternal reward, which indicates, again, him talking to the Galatians, a group of Christians, indicates to them that concept of once saved, always saved is not the case. As we become children of God, God requires of us that we transform our lives and live in newness of life toward Him, as Romans chapter 12 indicates. We're going to get into that in our discussion today as well. Okay, so I wanted to bring that up as well. Anybody want to add anything to the concept of sowing and reaping? The only other thing I'll make note of in verse 7, do not be deceived. Again, there is that danger of self-deception. People who think they're going to get away with it, that they can live that way and that God will still accept them, they're deceiving themselves. The final point, and this one is something that will segue into the text of Romans, is chapter 6 and verse 11. Just wanted to acknowledge the Apostle Paul's limitations physically. We've alluded to that on a number of occasions. We recognize, for example, that the Judaizing teachers, as they considered his appearance, they accused him of being contemptible in appearance. So, don't know exactly what Paul's problem was, but there were some physical problems that he had. He had, for example, thorn in the flesh. There may have been some type of palsy that he was suffering from, which is indicative or indicated by this particular verse. See with what large letters I have written to you with my own hand. The Apostle Paul, when he wrote, it was a hard thing for him to do. In fact, if you get into Romans 16 and verse 22, at the end of his epistle to Romans, there is a reference there. It's basically, let's put it this way. If I were dictating someone else's writing, and at the end of it I wanted everyone to know that the actual manuscript is penned in my hand, I might say, I, Stan Fox, have written this. And that's what Tertius said in Romans chapter 16, verse 22. The Apostle Paul identifies himself as the author of the letter to the Romans, but Tertius, a fellow laborer with Paul, actually wrote it down. Most probably, I don't know exactly how they did it, but most probably Paul simply dictated to him what he wanted to be written, and he copied that down. And he acknowledges that in chapter 16, verse 22 of Romans. So, when you look at commentators in regard to this, the indication would be that in these last few words here, that the Apostle Paul finished up the writing of the epistle to the Galatians. Not that he necessarily wrote out everything in that epistle, but you'll remember that he was very, very strong in his denunciation of their turn away from the gospel to another. And he had been dealing with them unsparingly throughout this entire epistle. At the end, he wanted them to know how important these things were, how much he cared for them. And so he laboriously, and again, a little bit of speculation here, but it seems to be indicated in verse 11, laboriously wrote out the final portion of the letter in his own hand. It's one of those things, my handwriting has gotten horrible as time has progressed, as I've gotten to where I use the computer more and more. Used to have very nice handwriting. I used to write on blackboards and stuff when I was young and preaching, and the ladies would come up to me and say, "Oh, I like your handwriting so much." Now it's an illegible scrawl for the most part. But anyway, with regard to the handwriting that is done, if you were to send out a thank you note, now what I would like to do is set up a form on the computer and just type up the thank you notes. Be a lot quicker to hit print. You can actually include a signature file at the end that has your handwritten. But if you get something like that in the mail, it doesn't have the same meaning that if someone actually handwrote a thank you note. And it is simply a meaning of acknowledging the thought that is intrinsic in the words. And I think there is something to that here with that phrase in verse 11. But I wanted to note that the Apostle Paul's love for the Galatians, but secondly, acknowledge that there seemed to be some kind of a physical malady that made it difficult for him actually to write his own epistles. And often he had a fellow worker do that for him. All right? Comments, questions about that? So that basically finishes up our study of Galatians then. So appreciate very much everyone's attention.
I read the scripture from training to the right hand. I didn't find it in time before we left that.
Concerning the right hand fellowship?
Your right hand, right. And it's Ecclesiastes 10 in verse 2. And sometimes, some are familiar with that, but it says, "A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left." And that's very apropos to this nation. It's on the left.
Oh, man. So someone actually explain what that means. Because I'm left-handed. Somebody tell me I'm all right.
Do your left hand.
Anybody have any thoughts? I mean, I really, truly think that it does have an indication of what is the norm in society. And in fact, if you go back in time, though I'm not in any way accusing the Old or New Testament writers of this, but there have been conventions made that left-handed people are evil. Fortunately, it was shortly before I went to school that this came to an end, but it was a common practice. And some of you may be old enough to remember that if you were in school and you were left-handed, the teacher would force you to write with your right hand and would compel you to stop being left-handed. That's not necessary anymore. The main thing about being left-handed that bothers me is that this is a right-handed world, and so there are a lot of combinations, and they're small things. I'm not complaining overly about it, but there are, I would be good as a Jew, because Jews rip from the bottom to the top and right to left, and that way my hand wouldn't get smudged like it does when I go the other direction. But we see those lefties doing this. I never learned to do that. But as a result, when I would write, I would smear what I wrote. And that's just one of the examples of that. But I think we've got the norm in society. Normal aspect is that right hand and the extension of those kinds of things. And there may be some other aspects of this with regard to sanitation and other aspects to that. But it's just the equating of that between right and left. That it's just like light and darkness. There's nothing evil in darkness, but darkness is used as an expression to correlate with evil, where light is with righteousness. And it's simply a way of demonstrating the difference between good and evil, or right and wrong. And so if you're going to do that, and the majority are right-handed, then that would be typical of what would be done. Yes, please.
Jesus right now is at the right hand of God. When Jesus in the judgment separates all men, the sheep will go to the right hand and the goats will go to the left. The idea of the right hand has to do with honor and authority. And I think it comes from the idea that most people in society at all times use the right hand. But you touched on it right now. In the East, the right hand was used for eating, the left hand was used for cleaning. You didn't cross over. You didn't do one or the other.
Yes, you did.
Mine was just peripheral. We know that words change in society, uses words to make things be the way they want it to be. And in my field, we do not say normal children, we say typically developing. So you may want to say that the world is typically right-handed.
Okay, so I'm not abnormal anymore. I used to be abnormal, but now I'm just not doing it. Well, I'm glad to know that. I'll try to be a little bit more understanding there.
You talked about the evilness of the left hand. I think probably Latin, I think. The right is dexter. We're dexterous, or do things equally with both hands, or ambidextrous. The left is sinister.
Okay.
Which we have our own meaning for sinister. But
the etymology of all that, that's interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Okay. Anybody else? Yes, please.
Paul's a story about Ehud when he was stabbed with the sword. I think it was Ehud, the one that stabbed him, extended his right hand and showed he had no weapon. So he was left-handed. So that's how he had a close turn.
And that certainly was sinister. Yeah, I forgot that. That's right. Yes, Dick.
Yeah, you're talking about how he was treated being left-handed. My youngest son being left-handed, grammar school, he'd come home. They call me a dirty left-hander, and to console him on that.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm a little bit bitter. We've been persecuted for many, many years. And I tell you, you can't use a pair of scissors. It's just not possible. Yes, sir?
We outlasted her.
Okay. Good deal. All right, let's go on to things a bit more serious than left-handedness.